All across America and around the world, this is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
And now, your hosts for today's program, Dale Thronberry and Bob Gould.
Good evening, good afternoon, good day, depending upon where you are in this world today. Bob Gould, Dale Thronberry.
Welcome to Veterans Radio.
It does help, right?
Hello. I'm here.
They all have little, well, anyway, we won't talk about that. Yes, with another chapter of Veterans Radio. It's the first time you and I have worked together in a while.
First time this year, that's for sure.
This year, right?
That's right. The year is young, although it is adventurous.
And we just completed 14 years, folks.
14. What?
We did. We just completed.
Really?
Yeah, 14
Holy
years.
Holy mackerel.
Yeah.
2003. Okay. All right.
You know how many presidents we went through?
Well, we've gone through. We're on our third so far.
I think so. Yeah. So
it should be interesting. That's for sure.
Think should be, yes, they, okay, we will. Today, we've got a program. We have the iconic M4 Sherman tank. I've always wanted to do a program on the Sherman tank. Why? Well, I'll tell you that in just a minute when we get to our guests. And we also have, first up, folks from Florida. Things must be very nice down there right about now, wouldn't you think so?
I would think so.
We have some folks from Florida that have something very exciting for veterans who have spinal cord injury. And Dale, you said you just found a letter from Vietnam.
No. My wife and I were going through some old letters, and she found a couple that I'd had that I'd sent to her while I was going through flight school and when I was over in Vietnam. And one of them, which was I thought was very cool, was called the Ten Commandments of Flight. And this is something that we had to kind of memorize as far as a little bit of the harassment of when I was going through flight school. And so I'll just read them, and I may have to explain them a little bit, but I thought they were kind of cool.
Read the first one.
Well, the first one was that thou shalt keep up thy RPM lest the ground arise up and smite thee. And that just means that if you don't keep the engine power strong enough, the ground will come up and hit you. The other way is, number two, is thou shalt be aware of the takeoff direction or the wind demon shall overcome thee. You always wanted to take off into the wind and land into the wind.
I would think so.
You don't want tailwinds. It's not good, especially in a helicopter. Thou shalt select a suitable forced landing area lest thou dash thy foot against a stone or a tree. We don't want to do that either. Thou shalt not sleep during the weather briefings. Lest the unknowingly fly into the famed cumulogranite cloud, better known as a mountain. Came very close to that one time. Thou shalt not take thy name of thy flight instructor in vain. Thou shalt always drain thy fuel sumps, lest the great waters choke off the bread of life. Moisture will collect in the fuel cells on a helicopter and probably on any other plane, too. So we always want to drain them before you start. Otherwise, you won't get a start.
We're going to have to talk to our tank guy about
that. Yeah, I'll bet they did have fuel or water in their fuel.
Condensation, yeah.
Thou shalt not contradict the mysterious ogre in the left seat, better known as the IP, lest thy grade slips turn pink, which is not good. Thou shalt begin the auto-rotation flare at 25 feet, lest the wings of flight fail thee, and thou would become an aviator of another world. I couldn't even write then. This is the same penmanship. Thou shalt always clear thyself before thou starteth a turn, lest thou crash with thy brethren, and ye both be rent asunder. Finally, 10, thou shalt always keep these commandments that it may be well with thee and thou livest long on the earth. Amen.
Amen. By the way, folks, if you would like to put your letter or something from Vietnam, Korea, we'd be glad to read it on the air or have you read it. Tell us, Dale, how do they get in touch with us?
Well, there's a number of ways you can get in touch with us now. But you can follow. Thank you. You can follow us
on the police department.
Yes, you can follow us on Facebook. We get a lot of great interesting posts
on
Facebook. Actually, you can follow us on Twitter. I won't go there, but you can follow us on Twitter and send us some information, or you could send us an email to either Dale or Bob at veteransradio.net, or you can go to veteransradio.net and click on the contact square, contact us, and we'll get that information, and we will get in touch with you. In fact, we've got a show coming up in the next couple of weeks from somebody that sent us in one of those. And a guy he wasn't a tank driver, but he was a truck driver in Vietnam, and he's written his own little book about that. And
so is this the guy who had the big truck, the 10,000?
No. This is a guy down in Georgia somewhere.
Okay.
And which is really kind of to our listeners, we really appreciate when you tell your friends about our program, because Bill, the guy who's going to be on the program, was referred by somebody else who had been on the program, who had been referred by somebody else that had been on the program. So we do follow up on the leads that you give us. You could even give us a call here today on the air. You can give us a call here
on
WAM. Mm-hmm. I will at 734-822-1600. That's in southeastern Michigan. Our toll-free number is 844-838-1600. That's 844-VET, V-E-T, 1600.
Our operators are standing by.
Yes, they are, as is the orchestra and band and all the musical accompaniments.
Well, folks, so that's our little get-together, right? That's our little get caught up.
It's our
Dale and I haven't talked in about 3 weeks, so we're just kind of getting all caught. But here we are. Let's get to the first guest. And I have, how are we doing? Do we have, yes, we do. Okay, our first guest today is Lisa Swiger. She's a program manager of Accessibility Services Incorporated. That's ASI, okay? You don't have to spell the whole thing out. She's worked with ASI for 6 years. She manages and coordinates services for veterans. Lisa and all of the employees at ASI, they're in Florida, by the way, folks, have an incredible passion for what they do. Well, it caught my attention. We get dozens of agents contacting Dale and I weekly to come on, to get people on the program. But what caught my attention is this device that they have that is called the Autonomy. I'm going to ask Lisa. Lisa, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
How do you say that? Autonomy?
It's actually autonomy.
Autonomy.
With a slightly different spelling.
Okay. You've put hundreds of units in VA hospitals around the U.S. What's a unit and what's a package?
Absolutely. A unit is going to be a combination of an environmental control system where the user is able to control things such as their telephone, television, call a nurse, all of these things using, a method such as touch, voice, sip and puff, or even their eye gaze, their eyes using an eye tracker camera. In addition to, for those that are nonverbal, the system is also a speech generation device.
That just kind of went going real fast. What was that about the eyes?
This piece of equipment is for anybody, but for veterans specifically, or quadriplegics, or suffering from MS, or any of diseases like that where they lose control of their extremities?
That's exactly correct. We have been working with the VAs for about 20 years now, and so the veterans are our primary clients. However, yes, it is available for any person, and you are correct. It is designed for the most severely disabled or those with debilitating diseases such as MS or ALS.
I think what Lisa, what would be really nice for our audience to understand is that when these people are quadriplegics, or they just can't control their hands or voice or feet or anything like that, is that they need these type of technology that you're talking about, where they're able to communicate without being able to use their hands. So they can, as you said, they can use this equipment. Is it on a wheelchair, or is it, how is it set up?
There is actually multiple options. So the brains of the system is about a 12-inch tablet computer, 12 or 13-inch tablet computer. And that is able to be mounted on something like a floor stand that in a home could move from room to room for somebody, mm-hmm. Or it can be mounted on a wheelchair mount. And, of course, it can go, you know, from one to the other. In the hospitals, we mount it on an arm that you'll often see in a hospital room, a TV mounted on a wall-mounted arm designed specifically for a hospital.
Mm-hmm.
And we often mount side-by-side to that TV, or if the TV's on the wall, we'll mount just our tablet. So it would be a swing arm that would swing up to the hospital bed. But again, in the homes, they primarily will have, as you mentioned, a wheelchair mount and then a mount on a stand somewhere else in their home for when they're not in their wheelchair.
Lisa, is this something that you and your, or I'm sorry, it was you, that's right, it's you and your husband that started this, isn't that correct? Nope.
Actually, no, it was my stepfather is the
That's
one that started
it.
Okay. The company 25 years ago.
Okay.
And him and my mother worked there for years and years and recently retired. And so now it is my brother and I that are primarily running the company.
Now these packages are going to be in VAs. You have a, after having the initial introductory period for your devices, your package, you now have a contract with the VA to provide this this equipment throughout the U.S. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Well, come to Ann Arbor.
The program.
Come to Ann Arbor.
primarily in the spinal cord, the main spinal cord injury units. And the VA has 24 of those across the country. So we are slowly getting into all of them. We've done them a little more than half right now and are currently, as you mentioned, in a contract that we're hoping we'll do it. We will do at least four additional spinal cord injury units at VA medical centers, and we're hoping it will be as many as eight. So we will be in just about all of them by the end of this year. We are in the spinal cord injury unit, as I said, and we install the unit at each and every bedside. So even though all of the veterans that are receiving care in these spinal cord injury units may not be quadriplegic mm-hmm. or suffering where they necessarily need the alternative input methods such as the eye gaze or being able to use it by sip and puff, but they can still use the system by touch.
Now, do you, one of these centers, is there any in Michigan, Detroit, Ann Arbor, or Battle Creek?
There is not in the Michigan.
Whoa. Yes?
I apologize. I was trying to think of one of the ones. We are in Chicago in the Hines VA Medical Center. They actually are, so far, our largest, I guess, number of units that we've installed there because they have a regular acute care spinal cord injury that's quite large. Mm-hmm. I believe that's about, if I want to say, remember correctly, 80 beds. And then they also have a long-term facility there right at the medical center specific for spinal cord injuries that we've also installed in. So they actually have over 100 units at bedsides there in Chicago. Some of the other areas or cities that we've been in, we are in the Bronx VA in New York. We are in the Memphis VA. We're in Long Beach, California. Three different medical centers in Texas. That would include Dallas, San Antonio, and Houston, among some others, of course.
Now, folks, if you want to get more information, of course you do, right? You want to go to ASIV. Wait a minute, how am I going to do this? www.asivveterans.com. There we go. ASI, I know, I'm thinking, how would you do? ASI Veterans, one word, .com. And there's a video that shows a veteran, U.S. Army veteran. You can see how this Army veteran uses the autonomy in his home. Tell us, Leeson, how can a veteran get an autonomy for themselves in the home? How do they do that?
Well, and I'll tell you, up until about 3 or 4 years ago, we were primarily just installing units in veterans' homes. And until this contract came about with the VA to put them at the spinal cord injury units. And so we have hundreds of them out in veterans' homes where the veteran would see their occupational therapist, nurse practitioner, one of their doctors, if they feel that this might be something that will be useful to them. On mm-hmm. our end of it, we typically receive a request, of course, to come out and assist the VA in evaluating a patient and go from there. But I can also tell you, if they are unsure of, their qualifications and things like that, that if there is a Paralyzed Veterans of America or a PVA representative, which there often are at VA medical centers, they are also very helpful and knowledgeable when it comes to these types of assistive technology and the funding that's available.
Dale, you have something.
I did have a question. I noticed in your literature that these veterans don't necessarily, it doesn't have to be necessarily a service-connected disability. It could be somebody who has ALS or advanced stages of Parkinson's also could utilize this piece of equipment. Is that correct?
That's absolutely correct. And believe it or not, something that is not widely known is that about 5 or 6 years ago, ALS actually is now considered 100% service connected. Hmm. So there's a number of benefits that are available to veterans with ALS that sometimes they are not aware of and should definitely inquire with their service representative or VA representative to see what they qualify for.
Yeah, I was going to say, I would strongly suggest anybody out there that has any of these issues, contact their PVA representative, the Paralyzed Veterans of America, and it sounds like they're the ones that had the road to getting hold of one of these things.
And I'm sure ASI in Florida would all, you don't have to be a vet, folks, to get this equipment. So if you happen to have a relative, friend, neighbor, turn them on to ASIveterans.com, ASIveterans.com. See the video, more information. Founder Fred Thompson's philosophy, we'll quote him, "We start with the customer and work backwards." He has inspired ASI's research and development engineers to stay one step ahead of technology, ensuring the company delivers the most advanced and progressive solutions available. You get the last comment. Comment on that, Lisa, right now.
Well, and yes, I just wanted to thank you again for your time and being able to get this information out there. As I mentioned, in addition to the hospitals, we are installing these in homes all across the country of veterans and others that are in need of a system like this, and look forward to providing any additional help or information we could to anybody interested.
That's ASIveterans.com, 1-800-933-8400. 1-800-933-8400. Lisa, will you come back on the program again?
Absolutely. We'd love to. I really appreciate it.
We'd love to have you. Thank you for being on the program, and we'll be talking sometime in the future. Take care.
Thank you both. Have a nice day.
Boy, that's really something, eh?
It is. I had a student recently who had, I don't know if it was this particular one, but he has advanced multiple sclerosis, I think it is. And he had a tablet on his wheelchair, and he would do everything on that to maneuver. And it was amazing what the technology can do. And we're so grateful. And we've got some other programs. That reminded me, we've got some other programs that are coming up that are going to be talking about some of these things. At the U of M right now, there is research going on in the regeneration of nerve endings for people who have had nerve damage, and they are doing that. There's another program down at Columbus, Ohio, that is doing 3D printing or 3D building of prosthetics. And all of these, many of these things, of course, are the result of military activity. And so they're working in connection with connection. That's not the word I want. Anyway, they're working, the VA and the civilian hospitals are working together to utilize the technology that is being developed and utilized by both of them. So I see the future as being better, you know, not perfect, but certainly going to be better for some of these veterans that are coming back with these severe injuries that, you know, as we were talking about earlier, that are going to be able to live out a pretty decent life.
Well, they reach my heart. We'll be right back. Chauncey, hit it. And we're back on Veterans Radio. Well, I've been waiting for years to do a program on this.
You are.
Oh, yes.
You have been.
The Sherman tank, M4 Sherman tank. I got one of the publishers sent me a book. There it is. It's a tabletop book. You know, what they call those coffee table books?
Yes.
M4 Sherman tanks, the illustrated history of America's most iconic fighting vehicle. And with us is the author, calling from Chattanooga, Tennessee. It's Michael E. Haskew, and he's been writing and researching military history subjects for over 25 years. He's the editor of World War II History magazine. Have you heard of those guys?
Yeah. Those are great magazines. A whole series of them.
Yeah, okay. You get them?
Some of them. You can pick them up at Barnes & Noble or your local bookstore, as they say.
Yeah. And the World War II Desk Reference with the Eisenhower Center for American Studies. He's the author of West Point 1915.
You know that class.
Oh, you know who was in that one. How about let's try Eisenhower Bradley? And, I mean, we're talking about some real stars that came out of that particular year. He also wrote a book on Appomattox, The Last Days of Robert E. Lee's Army of Northern Virginia. Now, 100 years of the world's most important armored military vehicle. Right. Okay, let's get right into it. Mike, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Bob, thanks so much. It's a pleasure to be with you today. I appreciate your having me.
Well, we're going to be talking tank, folks. And we got a break, what, at least four minutes. All right. But first thing I want to ask, why'd you do this? I mean, everybody wants
wife,
to make a few
bucks. You're the 100th person to ask
right.
me that question, but I, she was the first. But I'll tell you, the reason why this book was important to me and I considered it to be timely is that 2016 is the 75th anniversary of the Sherman tank. It entered production in 1941, so 2016 being the 75th year, we thought there was some symmetry there, and the publisher agreed, and it was a wonderful collaboration to put this book together with some history on the Sherman tank, its development and its role during World War II, obviously, and then the service life of this military vehicle that carried on for more than half a century. There's probably still a Sherman rumbling around out there somewhere today.
Where Dale and I are sitting, 30 miles from where we're sitting is where the Shermans were built here in Michigan. That just tells you a little something, folks. That's the arsenal of democracy. You hear that? It's not Long Beach, Oakland, Boeing, out there in Oregon. No, it happened right here in Warren, Michigan, 30 miles from where Dale and I are sitting. And you can still go by the plant. And tell us a little bit. We've got, what, at least three? 2 minutes, right? Okay. Real quick, tell us about manufacturing Sherman tanks in Michigan.
Well, you know, the Detroit Tank Arsenal was a marvel in itself. It was a sprawling facility and operated continually for decades and decades after World War II. And really, it was the brainchild of Kaufman Tuma Keller, the president of Chrysler Corporation. It wasn't long after the United States started to put its economy on a war footing that President Franklin Roosevelt made a phone call to William Knudsen, who was in the GM, General Motors chairman, and asked him to head the Office of Production Management. So a few days later, Knudsen gets on the phone with his competitor, and he's talking to Keller, and he says, "Hey, how would you like to build a few tanks for the Army?" So a few tanks turned out to be more like 50,000. And of that 50,000, the vast majority were built right there in Warren, Michigan at the Detroit Tank Arsenal. And the way that came about was, interestingly enough, General Charles Wesson was the Army's chief of ordnance at the time, and Keller was always an entrepreneurial guy, and he wanted to take advantage of an opportunity that he saw, and he got Wilson on the phone, or Wesson on the phone, and he said, hey, why don't you build a tank arsenal? And what he was suggesting was the ability to get the tank arsenal online, get tanks in mass production, and get the U.S. economy on a war footing and start producing the armored fighting vehicles that ultimately won World War II in the West. So just quickly, that's how the arsenal came to be. And it's just a fascinating story of industry partnering as a wartime footing approached, and the United States definitely becoming the arsenal of democracy. And the photographs that you see of those Sherman tanks on the floor, that Detroit tank arsenal being churned out, are pretty impressive.
You're darn right. We had the workers, we had the assembly line engineers, and we were putting together airplanes, we were putting together machine guns, jeeps, and tanks. And we have, 30 seconds until the break. Mike, I know you're going to hang out there. Go have yourself a cup of tea. We'll be right. Oh, we can hear the orchestra, right? There we are. A little bit. Yep. Okay. There we go. We'll be right back. You're listening to Veterans Radio right here on Talk Radio 1600 WAAM. We're back on Veterans Radio right here in Talk Radio 1600 WAAM, our flagship station right in beautiful downtown Ann Arbor, Michigan. Okay, I have Mike Haskew on the phone. He wrote M4 Sherman Tanks. And by the way, folks, you can all get yourself a Sherman Tank book. This thing is really great. It's got pages and it's big. It's a coffee table book. Who's your publisher on this?
The publisher on this particular book is Zenith Press, which is out of Minneapolis nearby. So it's a British corporation, Quarto Publications, and Zenith Press is one of their imprints here in the United States. And those folks are great over there in Minneapolis, so a shout out to them.
Mike, give us your website so folks can go to your website and get more information. What's that? How can they find out about the book?
Well, they can find out about the book by going to the Quarto USA, www.quarto website, and can pull up all the books that I've done with them, including this one, the book on the history of the tank, and also a third book on aircraft carriers, which I put together for them. And then as well, they also were kind enough to publish the West Point book and the Appomattox book that you mentioned earlier, Bob. And, of course, these books are all available through Amazon and through Barnes & Noble and bookstores near you. You can certainly order those if they don't have them in stock.
Well, we know that the Sherman tank, whenever you think of tanks in World War II, I mean, there was the Pershing. But we always think it's the Sherman tank. There's been jokes made about it, stories, books written about it. You wrote about it. And the Germans, their Tiger tank, their Panther, the Tiger, the Germans were engineering these machines. They were impregnable. And we, vis-a-vis, wanted to outproduce them. So we didn't have, folks, this engineering marvel, frontal armor, 14 inches, whatever. We outproduced them, although there was something that I read in doing my research that it was five Sherman tanks to take out one Tiger tank. And in talking with Mike, the other day, he said, Mike, that it wasn't frontal assaults. They had to get behind the German tanks, not shoot it out face to face. This is what we all thought, right? Battle to battle. No, they had to get behind the tanks to get to the vulnerable area. Tell us about that.
Well, the exhaust area, the rear area of the Tiger or the Panther tank was its most vulnerable, its least armored, and of course the business end of the tank most of the time pointed forward. So when a lightly armored Sherman in comparison to a Panther or a Tiger wanted to be successful in the attack, usually it did require more than one Sherman because of the need to distract or hold the attention or at least make the commander of a German tank aware that there was more than one American tank in the vicinity. And I remember a story that Alban Ehrsig, who was a real hero of World War II, he wrote up front for Patton, was General Ehrsig's book. He once came across a field and saw what he thought were five pristine Sherman tanks. And as he approached, he realized that these tanks were in reasonably good condition with one exception. Each of them had a 75-millimeter hole in its frontal armor that had been delivered by a Panther tank that was knocked out and was some distance away. So he walks over to the Panther tank and sees that that tank has been disabled and destroyed by a shot from the rear. So Ehrsig concluded that what had happened was that actually six Sherman tanks had engaged this single Panther. The Panther had successfully dispatched five of them, but it was the sixth that worked its way around behind the Panther and delivered a knockout blow with its 75-millimeter gun. And, you know, truth be known, it was a tactical error on the Americans' part. They bunched up. They didn't keep enough space between their machines when they approached this Panther and attacked. And that made easy pickings for a good, experienced German gunner with a high-velocity 75-millimeter cannon who didn't have to traverse that weapon very much at all to draw a bead on his successive victims.
Think of that, folks. You're a target, and didn't they call the American tanks had gasoline, the German tanks had diesel. Didn't they call the Shermans Ronsons? Tell us about that.
They did. One of the derisive nicknames for the Sherman was Ronson because it lights the first time and every time, was the slogan that the Ronson Lighter Company used. The Germans called them Tommy Cookers in an awful reference to the British soldier, the Tommy, who also populated many, many Lend-Lease Sherman tanks. There were a couple of variants of the Sherman that did have diesel engines, but for the most part, you're absolutely right, Bob. The vast majority of Sherman tanks had entered combat mounted the Continental R-975 engine, which was gasoline, or the Chrysler A-57 multibank engine, which was also gasoline. And those tanks tended to brew up, let's say, more quickly than a diesel tank did. And quite frankly, the Sherman was at a disadvantage in tank versus tank combat simply because of the lack of firepower and the fact that these German high-velocity 75-millimeter and 88-millimeter weapons could hit them many times at standoff ranges before that 75-millimeter gun could get in range.
I've had a fortuitous this past weekend. They had a program, of course, on the military channel on the Shermans, and Patton actually was on Patton and the Shermans, but here's something I want to. Harlem to Hitler, the all-African American tank battalion, the 761st, Harlem to Hitler. Isn't that great?
Yeah.
And tell us about that, and we'll go from there. Tell us about that battalion.
Well, as you know, the African-American contribution to the victory in the West, in Europe, and in the Pacific as well with the Marines and the U.S. Army was significant. The African-American soldiers were famous for their contributions to the Red Ball Express that carried ammunition and gasoline to the front lines across France 24 hours a day. They also did some of the most difficult work as far as, behind the lines. And the old adage is that it takes 10 soldiers in support roles to put one soldier in combat to keep them supplied and such. But there were combat units that were made up of African-American troops, and they performed extremely well when given the opportunity. We all know the story about the Tuskegee Airmen, the 555th Parachute Infantry Regiment that never actually saw action but performed well in a smoke-jumping role out in the American West during World War II. And then the 761st Tank Battalion was one of Patton's best. He commended them for their role in combat and was very, very proud of their effort. And also, several of those gentlemen received some of the highest decorations of our land that we offer, the Congressional Medal of Honor. They were recipients of a number of medals, and their combat record was very impressive.
I want to point out, folks, that in the very beginning, when this battalion was being formed, this unit was being formed, General Patton did not have a high opinion that this was going to succeed, and obviously he had changed his mind when he saw what these tankers did. Tell us just a little bit about that.
Well, yeah, that tank battalion was organized in 1942 and active right up until shortly after the end of the war, and it actually deployed in combat. They landed around Omaha Beach once it was settled in October of 1944, and there were about 700 of these guys. And Patton, of course, as you said, did not want them to be involved in his combat, but he later expressed the fact that that he was very pleased with their effort. And you know, during the Battle of the Bulge, the German soldiers that came in there disguised as Americans, the 761st. Fought those guys behind the lines, and they saw combat in that autumn in the Hürtgen Forest, in the Battle of the Bulge. They just amassed a tremendous combat record, and Reuben Rivers was, in fact, a member of that 761st that received the Congressional Medal of Honor for service in France. This was prior to the Battle of the Bulge, actually, on November 19th, 1944. He led Company A's tanks into a battle against the Germans and opened fire on some enemy tanks, and his tank was hit, and he was actually killed in action, but the leadership that he showed was recognized with the Congressional Medal of Honor.
During the program, one of the black crew members was talking about living in a tank. I've never been in a Sherman tank. I've seen them. I've crawled around them. I'd love to be in one. It looks, what do you think, Dale, claustrophobic?
Extremely.
Extremely.
I can't imagine what it would be like to be inside a tank.
Mike, how did they keep up with enough bandages for banging their heads, their knees, their elbows? How did they stay warm?
Well, these aren't old guys like we are now, Bob. You got to remember, these guys are mostly in their 20s, so they're young, and their joints don't ache and pop, and they've still got reasonably good backs, I would say. But you have to consider the confines of a medium tank, a Sherman tank, that has to accommodate not only the gun cradle and the breech and the recoil that gun is going to throw off inside that tank, but the other equipment that's involved and the ammunition that has to be stored inside the tank to make the weapon serviceable. And it's just remarkable that these guys were able to conduct themselves the way that they did, living every day, scarcely being able to obviously bathe or to cook a hot meal. In the cold weather, they actually would sit inside the tank when they were able and allow it to idle so that the oil in the engine crankcase would warm up and kind of put some warmth into the interior of the tank. And one old veteran tanker remembered that they would sometimes see an infantryman shivering outside the tank and invite him inside to warm up just a little bit. But you've got the standard Sherman crew of five men living in these confines, and it's just amazing that they were able to, in most cases, get along and perform the functions that they did. Maybe put a little can of potted meat over on the manifold and heat it up, Bob.
No, about that. No,
have we done that, Dale?
We have done it, Bob. This is Dale. My question is, approximately how many square feet were inside of a tank? I mean, if there were five people in there, how much space did they have?
Well, the space was obviously limited. The crew compartment in the Sherman tank was forward of the engine, and so you're looking at a space that's probably going to be no longer than 8 or 9 feet and no wider than 7 feet. So 9 by 7.
So you're in there with your best friends.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and you know, the engine took up quite a bit of space, and when you consider that the tanks carried dozens of rounds of high explosive or armor piercing mm-hmm. ammunition, and then they had the 30 caliber and 50 caliber machine guns, and you know, 300 to 600 rounds of Browning 50 cal is going to require quite a bit of space as well.
Well, we've got to take one more break. Chauncey, are you going to get that? Let's get a couple of PSAs. Mike, in the meantime, get yourself a cup of tea. We'll be right back. Folks, you're listening to Veterans Radio right here on Talk Radio WAAM in beautiful Ann Arbor, Michigan. Take it. And we're back on Veterans Radio. Dale Throneberry, Bob Gould, bringing you another adventure here in Veterans Radio. Okay, and with me, with us right now, is Michael Haskew, the author of M4 Sherman Tanks and other books. Real quick, Mike, once again, tell our listeners how they can get this book.
You can get the book through Amazon.com, through Barnes & Noble, through your local bookstore, or you can visit the Zenith Press site at QuartoUSA.com. And sign up and get that book along with a number of others that I've been privileged by those folks to publish. So thanks for that, Bob. I appreciate it.
Well, that's Michael E. Haskew, H-A-S-K-E-W. Michael E. Haskew. Google it, folks.
And you can also, I don't mean to interrupt, but you can also, if you're listening to the program on the Internet through our website, you can just back up a little bit and click on the cover of the book there, and it'll take you right to the Amazon website, and then we get a nickel of it.
Did you do that, Dale? I mean, I don't know
how to do that, but I know we've done it.
I don't know. I didn't know that we did.
Yeah, all of the books that we've talked about here on Veterans Radio for at least the 5 or 6 years, we have available on our website. So just click on the book. It'll take you right to Amazon, and you can order it and right there.
I think you should, folks, because it's a great, great size, a lot of wonderful pictures, photographs, and, of course, Patton is in here, and good stuff.
I have to ask a quick question. I'm assuming that the Sherman tank was named after Tecumseh Sherman?
You know, Dale, that's absolutely right, William Tecumseh Sherman, and we can thank our British allies for that. It was the British that named each of the American tanks that you'll recall that participated in World War II, particularly early on, the Light Stuart tank, the M3 Grant Lee tank, the M4 Sherman. Our British friends were the ones that gave them the nicknames of the American generals from the Civil War. So you're absolutely correct.
Okay. My claim to fame there is that my great-grandfather marched with Sherman on the March to the Sea, and that my grandfather was named Sherman after him.
Well, I'm sure that the next time you have dinner in Savannah, you'll be welcome if you tell the waitress that.
I'm sure I will.
Well, yes, all right. Well, getting back, though, to the tanks, here we go. October 44, the Sherman tanks had converted their 73-millimeter to a 76-millimeter main gun. That you know what, Dale had a max range of 8 miles? Imagine hitting something 8 miles away. They wouldn't even know
it's hitting stuff 8 feet away. So
they wouldn't even know it's coming. Anyway, I wanted to highlight in October 44, Fort Drouin, which were concrete bunkers that were protecting the Lorain area. And Patton, in his approach, is always attack, 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 frontal, move, 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 and it didn't happen. In fact, he had to pull back the different things that they tried to get the infantry in there. They used something called snakes. Why don't you tell us about that, Mike?
Sure. You know, the Metz is well known as a quote unquote fortress city, and nowhere in Patton's march across France and to the German frontier was he more frustrated or stymied than he was before the city of Metz, and particularly at Fort Drouin. That fortress was old and had been upgraded and remodeled and refurbished and strengthened by both the French and the Germans over time. And when Patton reached Metz, he knew that the key to the city was Fort Drouin. The problem was that Fort Drouin actually housed five main guns of 150 millimeter, which is a very powerful weapon in its batteries, and also a lot of the fortress had been constructed underground, so it was difficult to reach some of the areas where the vitals, let's say, of Fort Drouin. But nevertheless, Patton did his darndest to crack that nut, and the 5th Infantry Division was the unit that drew the short straw, let's say, to attack the fort. And actually, in the fall of 1944, they started the campaign to try to reduce Fort Drouin. The Tactical Air Command sent P-47 Thunderbolt fighter bombers in there to soften it up. A couple of companies of the 11th Infantry Regiment and the 18th Tank Destroyer Battalion hit Fort Drouin in September and were not successful. 735th Tank Battalion went in there, and those snakes you're talking about are explosive-filled pipes, and the tanks would push them forward, and they would try to blow outer defenses, possibly even get them into the firing slit of a machine gun position or whatever, just to crack the nut of Fort Drouin. But the issue, really, for the 76-millimeter gun in the Sherman tank was twofold. One, when you put steel-reinforced concrete that's as thick as the average, let's say, office desk, you know, 3 feet maybe, with a small firing slit for a machine gun, only a direct hit into that vulnerable firing slit from a forward position is going to do much damage at all. The deflection of those shots would lessen their impact. The ability to actually fix a target when very little of it is exposed above ground was also an issue for the tankers. And so it was very frustrating, particularly in a limited area of fire. They couldn't just come in and fire massive broadsides, shot after shot, shell after shell at these fortifications. So it was very frustrating. And the fighting there lasted about 2 or 3 weeks before Patton decided to go ahead and just bypass Fort Drouin. And it did not fall until December. And it was not completely captured. It was actually surrendered when the rest of Metz surrendered after Fort Drouin was bypassed. And so it may be looked at as, I guess you could say, either the most visible or the only real defeat that Patton experienced during his drive eastward through France. So Fort Drouin was a tough nut to crack, and the armor-piercing shells and the high-explosive shells, particularly high-explosive, were very effective against open enemy gun emplacements, troop concentrations, things of that nature, were not effective against the bunkers and the casemates in Fort Drouin.
Once again, folks, the book is M4 Sherman Tanks. The author is Michael E. Haskew, Haskew. And you can get this at Barnes & Noble, whatever. It's really a nice Tome. How about that, Tome? Huh? Okay,
foreign language.
We've only have a few minutes before the program's going fast today. But what I want to talk about now is American, you know, people were saying, oh, the Atlantic Wall. No, nothing was going to beat the American Army. Nothing. Nothing was going to beat the American Army. And here we hit the hedgerows. We, right after Normandy, we hit the hedgerows. Nobody, the Bocage, nobody knew about this. It was slaughtering. What, we couldn't get the tanks in there because of these sunken roads. What? And the American GI challenged that. Tell us about that, Mike.
Oh, sure. So this is one of the great stories of American ingenuity during World War II, and General Eisenhower knew that it had come from the ranks, and the fact that it was successful made it all the more sweet. When the Americans and British finally started to move out of the beachheads there in Normandy and swung south and east toward their further objectives, they ran into an area in France called the Bocage, the hedgerow country. And these hedgerows are massive earthen structures that have been in place since the Middle Ages, Bob. It's hard to comprehend unless you've seen them, but some of these things were 15 feet tall with trees growing out of the tops of them. And so what you would have is a country lane, narrow, dirt cattle path that you would see an American Sherman tank supported by infantrymen funneled into a killing zone where German infantrymen would set up an anti-tank gun, very effective anti-tank gun. A German tank would lie in camouflaged in wait, German machine gun position, or single soldier with a Panzerfaust anti-tank weapon, a shoulder-fired weapon, would be waiting just as that Sherman tank came into the country lane with no room to maneuver, nowhere to go, and was a sitting duck. So what's the solution? The solution is not to go around the hedgerows, it's to go through them, right?
Yeah, man.
So a sergeant, Curtis Cullen of the 102nd Cavalry Reconnaissance Squadron, part of the 2nd Armored Division, is credited with the idea of welding steel blades to the front of the Sherman tank hull. He did the same thing on the M10 tank destroyer, by the way, which also utilized a Sherman hull. So what he did was, They knew there was an abundance of scrap metal, particularly from the hedgehogs and obstacles on Omaha Beach and the other invasion beaches, and so they cut that up with torches, and Cullen devised a row or a system of plow-like cutters that would allow the tank to push through those mounds of earth without really having to expose the thin underside, and that's where the tanks were thinnest armored on their tops, their deck, and on the underneath, on their underside, so they could climb these mounds pushing through without having to expose the underside of the tank, and it helped the American Army to move through the Bocage country, and they were very successful, and the British also used scrap metal to do that as well. I think they got that idea from us Americans.
You know, what was so sweet is that, as Mike mentioned, we took the very steel that was used, Belgian gates, on Normandy, and sent it right back to them, man. That was so cool. You've got, what do we have, Nina? A minute and a half. Oh, less than. Oh, the band's getting up, the orchestra. Okay, you get last word, Mike. Don't forget, folks, it's M4 Sherman Tanks. Mike Haskew, Haskew. Mike, you get the last word.
Well, I've got something great for you guys up there in Michigan and around Detroit. A young PFC named Frank Upton served in the Pacific, and the Sherman was also in the Pacific where it dominated Japanese armor. That's another story for another time. But his former sergeant there went on a recruiting tour in the States, and he wrote a letter to his sergeant, and he said, "If you go to the Chrysler Tank Arsenal, I want you to find the head man and kiss him on the forehead for me."
I like that. I think we can leave it at that. Mike, please come back. Thank you very much for being on the program. Take care.
My pleasure. Thanks to you guys.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Wow. The orchestra's going? Right. I'm glad we paid the guys, you know. Oh, we got 30 seconds. I want to thank Nina. Nina, she's shaking her head, yes. And our producer, Derek, there he is, right? And Dale and myself. Until next week, next program, you're dismissed.